Well, thank you. I've never been quite welcomed this way before, but I sort of like it. Thank you very much. Sociology of religion. That's what I tried to do, continue trying to do. One kind of friend who said that a sociologist of religion would be like someone who would have two children and send one of them to church and keep the other one at home and see if it made any difference in them. I really didn't do that, but sociologists of religion sometimes have a pretty bad reputation. Our job it is to try to discern trends and analyze patterns and make some sense of social and religious change, and to do it as in as value neutral a way as possible. And that becomes particularly important today, given for someone who teaches in a public university, we've got every religion known under the sun at UCSB, and some that are just now being created probably as I speak. So one has to be careful what one says in that environment, and to try to be fair and honest with all possible views. So sociology as a discipline is only like 150 years old, and it arises out of the Enlightenment. And I want to say this because the book you're reading by Diana Butler Bass has a lot in there to say about the origins of modern study and ways of looking at the world, and the Enlightenment, that era back there four centuries ago, is so critical because that's when there was a major confrontation between existing patterns of traditional religion coming out of the medieval era and all the new things that were coming about with what this thing we call modernity. Mainly science, mainly the application of reason to all areas of life, new understandings about how the world operates, and all of that, of course, raised lots of issues about what is religion and how does religion relate to the world, and how do we have some new models of how religion and the world connect after we have moved into the scientific and more rational era, which is, of course, still unfolding. So I say this because your author makes a big point of that and then goes to say that we are living in a time which is characterized by many words like the easy word is modern. The more critical word is hyper-modern or ultra-modern. And then if you want to go all leap really forward, the most critical word is post-modern. Now, scholars can't agree among those labels, and people sort themselves out about that. But I noticed Diana mentions all of those, and then sort of settles on the one that I settle on, which is post-traditional, which is a little less aggressive than certainly post-modern. But one of the things that you have to understand about these labels is that which we in the academy and around the world are all trying to get some grasp on rapid social change. And California is a very good place to think about that because we're, somebody said, what's California like? And I think it was one of our poets some years ago said, well, it's like the rest of the country, except only more so. And I think that sort of grabs the thing about California. It's hyper-modern. That is to say, we live in the midst of unprecedented social change. Unprecedented to the human species. Social change. I mean, we've had, obviously, periods of history which were critically full of change, revolutions and whatnot, but I mean, we have sustained social change. And part of what this argument about hypermodernity or postmodernity or post-traditional is about is that, is, and it means many things, but one fundamental thing in there is that we live in a world of incredible mobility, movement, and I'm talking not just physical movement, but also, and perhaps in more important ways, mental movement, because we are barraged constantly by new information. We live in an information-oriented society, many words to describe our time, information-oriented society. So we are forced to be changing our views pretty often if we want to keep up with whatever is the prevailing view of the time, because information base is changing. Now, you think about it, we change more often in probably a year's time in our way of thinking about the nature of the world around us than people perhaps did in an earlier time over 500 years. I mean, the world was much more static and closed and permanent, so to speak, compared to the world in which we live, where we are now accustomed to, or increasingly accustomed to, rapid social change. I always like to cite my little medical analogy about social change, and that is that I used to suffer from this incredible disease called gout. I don't anymore because we got the medication now that solves it. Which right there is another thing about modernity. We can control things better than people used to be able to, right? But here's my little twist on this one. So for a long time, about 10, 12 years ago, my doctor said that really, you know, the best thing I can tell you is quit eating strawberries. And I said, "Doctor, I really like strawberries." He said, "Quit it. That's research shows that that's bad to gout." So I went off of strawberries for about 2 years, and I'm in my doctor's office, and he said, "Oh, you remember what I told you about gout and strawberries?" I said, "Yeah, I sure do. I haven't eaten a strawberry." 2 years. He said, "Oh, forget it. You get new research that shows it doesn't matter." So, you know, that's the world in which we live. We think we got an answer, but in fact, we don't. Maybe not have an answer. Or the answers are shifting. So, that's part of this thing called rapid social change and ultra-modernity. And linked to that is not only the information explosion, which the internet is a perfect example of. It's all out there. A lot of facts, not so much wisdom, a lot of facts. Linked to this is this instant communication world in which we live. You know, constant inputs from elsewhere. You know, telephones, internet, email, constant stuff, right? So we're like saturated with all these inputs. So the communications revolution of modernity, huge. And as we know, communication has a lot to do impacting upon religion. It impacts how we think about the religious other. We see images on television and elsewhere. We the way we think about the other, how we perceive our neighbor who's different from us, all of this is bound up not just with our own experience, but with how we have been influenced by the media and all these other sources of information. So that leads me then to this word post-traditional, which, as Diana suggests, is she thinks it's the best word, and I tend to agree. And that is that in a traditional world, you would have all of this much slower, less change, and we would be guided more by our ancestors from the past. We would just simply try to carry on what we were taught, and on and on. But in a post-traditional world, while we obviously carry some of that past with us, we are constantly having to revise and rethink the present and to anticipate a future that will be strikingly different. So the ratio, if you will, to change and continuity, it's always an interesting question. If you think about life, you know, there's change and there's continuity, and we treasure continuity, but we also have to embrace change. We resist a lot of change, but at some point we have to embrace it. That ratio has been shifting in favor of the on the change side over against the continuity side. So in that sense, we might use the phrase, we're post-traditional. And any of these terms say more than you really want them to say, but they grasp something. So now, in a world like that, that's been evolving for several centuries, and the big question becomes, you know, what happens to religion? What happens to the dynamics of belief? So, if we're living in a world where there's less attention to the faith of the Father, so to speak, or the faith of the Mother, less attention to take it as it's been handed down to us, what kinds of changes can we see in there that's going to affect everyday practice of religion? Well, one obvious thing that's been changing is that religious authority has been losing some of its significance. And that's been going on ever since Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation, and certainly the printing press and putting the Bible in people's hands, right? People have been saying, oh, I can read for myself. I don't have to depend upon what the authority of the church says necessarily as being the gospel truth. So the declining authority of religious functionaries is part of this big picture as it relates to religion. Another thing that has happened and is happening and will continue to happen is, as Diana points out in her book, that the people's religion has become more important relative to the religion of the authorities. So the people's religion. How do people who assume authority to read for themselves and to think for themselves and to formulate moral convictions for themselves, how do they practice their religion and faith? So the people's movement, we in the sociology discipline often talk about this as lived religion. There's like religion of the text, and there's religion of the elites who tell us what they think it means, but then there's the lived religion of the people. So the emphasis shifts to the people and how they deal with religion, how they practice it. Third thing, it must do so. That's a good point you're on. I forget, but I think it's clear in the three. The third thing is that as that's going on, we have something like increased alignment of religion and ideology. By which I mean, if we begin to think more for ourselves, as we have and do, something enters into the equation other than just religion. We get grabbed up by prevailing ideologies, political ideologies. Hence, it should be no big surprise that in the present context, in this country, we see ourselves caught up in so-called culture wars over lots of issues, right? Lots of issues. And we see ourselves politically aligned. It used to be a two-party system. I don't know what you call it now. But we are aligned politically, so that our religion and our politics sort of get fused together. It's hard to keep them separate, again, at the lived religious level. So we end up with things like conservative politics seemingly linked to very traditional forms of religion, and progressive politics linked to more progressive, more somewhat liberal-oriented views toward religion. That's the world we're in right now, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm trying to say is, and we all know that, what I'm trying to tell you is that the source of that lies in the fact that the authority for religion has become more individually oriented. So I say less and less the church says, you can say that as a point of reference, but for you personally, it's less and less the church says, and more what I say in relation to the church, because I'm carrying on a kind of dialogue about my life in relation to what maybe the church says, what the Bible says, whatever these other kind of points of authority might be. But it's an ongoing internal dialogue, and that means that the things that affect my decisions religiously are also external in the environment, such as politics. So these two have become fused. And despite all Americans say about separation of church and state, that's a formal constitutional issue. At the lived religious level, religion and politics hang together. And in our time, they're hanging together in multiple clusters. We're united only in the sense that we think you ought to think it through and you know, vote your conscience. But some interesting things have happened in the norms relating to politics and religion in this country, particularly in this modern era. It was the case that up until about the 1970s, the prevailing norms about relation of religion and politics was that religious institutions should encourage people to vote. To be a good citizen, you ought to vote. Religious institutions should agree on that. That was mainly what religious institutions did, at least according to the normative system. There have always been exceptions to this, of course. But basically encourage Americans to vote, but not to identify candidates. That's just been the prevailing view. Up until about 1970. And in those years, things began to change. So by the time we get to 1980, and I know nothing about your political persuasions, but I'm making an empirical observation when I say this. It was Ronald Reagan who is identified as the president in whose time the norms really shifted. And it's an issue larger than anyone figured, certainly larger than Reagan, but Reagan said something which made a profound difference in this political religious connection in American life. I don't know if you recall this, but we had the evangelical movements, the evangelical Christian movements, in an upswing at this time, and there was the National Evangelical Association that was meeting, and they invited candidate Reagan for the running for president, to meet. And Reagan made this profound statement, which captures what I'm talking about. He said to the group, "I know you can't endorse me." That's the old system, right? I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. The gates were open for all that we've seen ever since. And I don't want to put too much emphasis on the Reagan part of this story, but the fact is that Soon we would have scorecards for candidates. Soon we would have church websites, as we got into the website era, with coded words that would suggest to you what your politics should be. I love the one down at my wife's hometown in Calpin, South Carolina, that I noticed about 20 years ago. A little church slogan on the church sign that said, you know, things are a little less educated down there. So we had, the first word was wanna, W-A-N-N-A. Wanna go to heaven? Turn right and go straight. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that's saying more than just turn right and go straight. You know, so code words, and then of course we got into more explicit endorsements for candidates. So we're now living in this period of incredible alliance between religious interest and politics, while we at the same time sort of talk about separation of church and state. So what all of this has done with the whole culture war thing and with the shift in the way in which religion and politics connect is we've got these new alignments, both between religions and within religions, which is to say that progressive-minded people have become more identified with other progressive-minded people, no matter whether there are, you know, Lutherans, Catholics, Jews, whatever, as compared to connections with their own members of their church. And the same thing holds for the conservative, more traditional-minded. So we got this interesting new way of thinking about religion. It used to be much simpler. It was never very simple in the American context. We've got so many denominations and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of groups. But at least we could say we've got Baptists, and we've got, you know, and then after Southern Baptists and High in the Sky Baptists and God knows what. But then you'd have, you know, Catholics, Roman Catholics, Orthodox, you know, and Jews, and on and on and on. So we'd have kind of that level of analysis. But now we've got all of that. Plus, we've got within each one, progressive sector and conservative sector. So that if you really want to try to understand it, you know, diagrammatically, you've got to look at what's going on for, say, progressives across these boundaries, and what's going on for the conservatives across these boundaries, or any other constituencies. I'm just using these extremes. So the picture, the organizational picture, has become much more complex and far less predictable. Because the progressives and the conservative traditionalists are very issue-oriented, right? So as issues come and go, change, the constellations change a bit. And the fact of the matter is, we know from research that most Americans, are caught in the middle on a lot of issues that seem to divide us. So that what the media picks up on, of course, are the extremes. And just listen to the media now. You know, with the whole new Congress that's in the making, you know, they go for the big story at the extremes. The conservatives are going to do this. The liberals are figuring out what to do over here. But if we look at the populace as a whole, most Americans are sort of caught in the middle and sometimes shifting their views from one issue to another issue, so that there's not necessarily a conservative on X, Y, Z, Z, you know, all the issues, and a liberal on all the same things. It's much more complex. All this to say, the picture has become much more difficult to analyze in terms of religion and society than it used to be. Now, Diana has this word that's been used by others that I also wanted to comment on. talks about fluid faith. You remember this?
Yes.
Fluid faith. That fluidity is linked to all the things I've been talking about. Individuals thinking more for themselves, conscience-oriented rather than necessarily tradition-oriented or authority-oriented. We become our own authorities in many respects. Fluid faith. We've got a lot of words in the vocabulary today, in the popular vocabulary, about that point toward that fluidity. We talk about religious growth or spiritual growth. What does growth mean? It means you're in process. You're not there necessarily. Your movement is fluid, right? So spiritual growth. Journey. A lot of journey talk, right? I'm on my journey, you're on your journey, maybe our journeys will cross paths. Journey. Holistic. That's like getting my gal and my religion all together, you know. Holistic, my body, my whatever. And in another sense, this fluidity has to do with just what I was saying about all these issues that around which people coalesce. There's kind of a worldly character to all this. That is to say, not worldly in the sense of anti-religion, but worldly in the sense of we are connected to real issues that we bring into our way of thinking as a religious or spiritual issue. Be these things abortion, homosexuality, or environmentalism, or on and on and on. You know, there's no end to issues. But much of our faith in a fluid context is linked to these issues that are defined as not just culturally important, but as religiously important. So, in that sense, we're kind of captive to fluidity. But fluidity implies things are going to always be changing. And we're always going to be shifting, growing, absorbing new issues, trying to deal with new problems. And that's the way we understand life today, in this more intense way. Now, in all of this, there's another big thing going on, which I think is crucially important. And that is the ways in which, in the modern late modern, centuries, use another word, ultra-modern world, or the post-traditional world, we selectively interpret scriptures to fit the circumstances. Now that sounds a bit harsh. I don't mean it quite so cavalierly. But the fact of the matter is that if you look carefully at the progressives and the conservatives talk about, say, the Bible, you'll see that they typically pick different texts to form a basis for the belief system. Now, what I'm trying to suggest to you is that religious meanings are shaped and created through a process of selective appropriation of scripture and of tradition. We can find the verses, the passages that seem to fit a constellation of concerns that we have, and those who differ from us will find a similar set that emphasize or legitimate, justify their views. So part of this thing about living in a post-traditional world is that we are recreating tradition, but recreating tradition as we want to create it, as we select, so that this is carried, you know, this is going on all the time. It's been going on certainly in the modern era, but we see how intensely it's carried on, particularly in the last 25 years or so, when we've had not just this great polarity of kind of traditional versus more progressive views, and each of them kind of say, ah, oh, but let's lay claim to this aspect of the tradition. Others say, no, let's hold on to this part. And aside from all that, we've had this tremendous growth of special purpose groups. You are one. Special purpose groups. There are hundreds, there are thousands of groups. Many with religion in the title, or some word connected to religion, but many that would seemingly be just plain old secular groups, but actually that's one of the things that many religious people have discovered. They can get a lot more influence if they use non-religious words that have kind of religious interpretation. So now we get this outgrowth of groups that connect to people with similar views or circumstances. What am I thinking of? I'll tell you exactly what I'm thinking. I'm thinking about, as an example, the motorcyclist for Jesus. They go up right in front of my house twice a year up to the mission. Father Virgil used to bless them, you know. So right, I live on Mission Street. So, all these motorcycles would go up to the mission twice a year. And the 30 minutes later, they come coming back down. Totally blessed. Now, that's just an example of a proliferation, huge proliferation of group-based or niche-based groups that say we can understand faith better, or there's certain insights to faith that applies to us in the context of our job, our hobby, our marital status, our life experience situations,
sexual orientation,
that's big, on and on and on. So we get thousands of groups. Literally, thousands of groups. There's no end to the spin-offs on this. And then it's a little bit like chicken soup books, you know. There's always a new amount of some new group, you know. It started out as chicken soup for the soul, and that's what it was like for all of us. But then they discovered niche marketing makes more money. Niche marketing. Chicken soup for women's souls. Chicken soup for the kids' souls. And before long, we got the handicapped kids' souls. And before long, it's, you know, on and on and on. There's no end, as I say. If you just keep this going. They've done about 30 or 40 of these books now. They keep specifying. Religion has been going through something of the same. Religion on the ground, at the popular, little religious level, has been going into something like that as well. And even within churches, you see some emphasis on activities and programs for select constituencies. But at the popular level, much of it being outside the religious institutions, we've got this marketing process that seems to suggest that in the context of your lived situation with people of similar situation, outlook, context, whatever, that in that situation there's something to be gained toward developing spirituality. Along with this has come a lot of emphasis in the past, 30 years on spirituality. Obviously that's a word that's been around a long, long time. But the point is that the media has discovered it, and the book industry has discovered it, and the mass marketing of these themes has helped to shape a new sensitivity about I should take charge of myself. Now that's part of this whole thing in the modernity too. I've got to do so. It's my story, it's my narrative, I've got to develop it. I have to help define my own spirituality, and I pick and choose the sources that will help me to do that, including a lot of picking and choosing from one church to another. Yeah, you notice that? People move around. And the Pew Forum that does these surveys about once a week recently had one about 3 months ago showing that a third of Americans actually say they go to more than one church. They go, part of it has to do with, because families are so interfaith oriented now, you know, there's her church, his church, you know, and whatnot. So there's a lot of kind of mobility. Talk about fluidity and mobility again. A lot's going on at that level as well. So perhaps a little bit less anchoring in one sense of tradition or in one place, and more checking out where the support and encouragement can be found. So all that's going on. Now, what I want to do, I've got two things to show you. And I want to go to this whole, back to where we're talking about religion and politics. Now, what I'm going to show you here comes from a survey that was taken in 2006. So yes, it's 4 years old, and we were in the Bush era, birth of the Bush era. And I think this illustrates some very important points. So, okay, I hope this will work. By the way, I first showed this in, I was invited to give a lecture in Paris, and the French are always so difficult to try to get through to. And so I thought I would start by celebrating their great man they sent to the United States. That's Alexis de Tocqueville, who came in the 1830s. And they still say, you know, it's our gift to you. So I just want to say, we're happy you did this. Thank you very much. So that was just to try to ingratiate myself to my French audience. It has nothing to do with the context. Okay, now, this is based upon a study on the four gods of America. It's recently come out of the book. And the four gods is like images of God, right? So, imagery. We're talking about how does one think about God? What's the image of God? And in the Western tradition, I think there's considerable agreement that if you wanted to define two basic dimensions of how Americans, and not just Americans, but Westerners overall, have thought about God, it's been on these two dimensions. One dimension is God engaged in the world or not? In effect, is God an active, intervening God? So people have said, yes, very much so, and others, no, less so. And then the other dimension is, does God get angry, and is God punitive? Is God a judgmental God? And we get split dimensions on that. From low to high. So now, sociologists love these cross tabulations. They're very simple, but that's where stopping this, all right? They're simple. And so if you cross tabulate, high and high, low and low, and the four cells here, you get, over here, you get the authoritarian God. High on God's active in the world, and God is high on being angry and punitive. Authoritarian. Here it is, folks. This is the way it is. Here you get the benevolent God, which is high on engagement in the world, but low on the anger punitive dimension. The distant God is low on engagement, that's by definition, distant, and low on the anger. God is just there. And then over here is the critical God, where we get a God that is high on the punitive, but low on involvement in the world. Now, if you think about it, authoritarian God is in kind of biblical imagery, is the judge. The benevolent God is the caring God, loving, caring, supportive, nurturing God. The distant God is like the deistic view of God. God created the world, left it alone. It just runs by its own laws, doesn't intervene. The critical God is not involved very much in the world either, but he or she will get you in the world to come. In that sense, critical and judgmental, but only in the next life, not in this life. So with that little scheme in mind, I want to show you how some things fall out. Now here's how Americans fall out on that scheme. 31%, slightly more, on the authoritative God image. The next largest group is 24% down here, a little over 24% on the distant God. By the way, that proportion was the highest when broken down by the states in California. The distant God image was the highest in California than anywhere else in the country. So 31% is the large figure here. But if you think about it, this is spread out pretty randomly. I mean, it's not like highly concentrated. 31% is the biggest, 24% is next. Then the benevolent God, 23%. And I suspect that's the one that most of us would connect more with, right? Right here. And then the critical God, the smallest of the four. Okay, so there is kind of how this falls out. Okay, look at this. Religious indicators, when you look at these various constituencies. Look at the authoritarians compared to any of the others. 51%. These are the people most likely to be regular, really regular churchgoers. Or have benevolent next, and then you're down to these low figures over here with the distant gods. Pray daily, we get, again, similar patterns all the way down. Pray daily, much higher here. They can all be higher on the authoritarian side. Jesus is the Son of God, 41%. God is a He, 56%. And you see how these figures just really peter out over here. It's like, you do get, the culture carries this one. You don't have to be much of a believer to start saying, well, yeah, that's what said, Jesus is the Son of God. I find these two very interesting to look at. Biblical literalists, look at that. 61% is compared to 27% over here. It says what it means and it means what it says, kind of outlook. Okay, now look at some of these issues. Now, abortion wrong, even if rape. So here's your big figure, but they declined, as you might predict. Abortion's wrong even if it's a health danger for the mother. Similar pattern. Now this next item, cohabitate. You should have heard the response from the French on this one. Are you serious? Or whatever the French translation for that is. But look at that figure. God favors the U.S. Here the French said, we knew that. You people believe that. Trust Bush. Look at this one. Iraq war is justified. Yeah. Okay, that's the way it falls. There it falls. We have to take it as it comes. We can't twist it. Yeah. But you notice these figures are all sort of high relative to some of these other items, all the way across. I mean, even look here. Look, 29% of these folks are in agreement, and they're much less so on the other items. Now, broken down by these large religious traditions. We can't break it down by denominations or for profits. We don't have enough. Anything struck you as interesting in that stuff?
No.
The distance.
Yeah, but look at Catholics. Look at this. Most Catholics came out at the distance. Look at Jewish. Not a personal God. God's off somewhere else.
We're trying to catch up.
Now, these figures over here are the atheist response. I just don't even believe in God. All right. So the comparisons are really among the other four. So I think it's interesting. First of all, I think the Black Protestant scores are very interesting here.
Yeah.
Very high on the authoritarian. Evangelical Protestants right up there too. Mainline Protestant, pretty low as Catholic on the authoritarian. So here's your largest benevolent among mainline Protestants. Most are here. No, it's not true. Most are over here. Distant and benevolent. These two sort of compete with one another. Jewish, distant, far out, head. Look at the people unaffiliated. By the way, about 18% of Americans today say, I don't connect to any organized religion. But look at 36% of these folks have a distant image of God. And 41% of that group say, they're atheists. More issues, progressive indicators. Government should protect the environment. Here you get almost unanimity across all God imager sets. So that tells you there's strong support out there for that. Regulate business, pretty consistent too. In fact, on all of these, there's more consistency on the other. Abolish death penalty. The highest category are the distant people. But, you know, it's not that different. Expand fight on terrorism against 2006. You're pretty high across, less so over here. Fund faith-based organizations. You know, this is the whole use of public funds by government to fund religious institutions to provide certain kinds of services. So we've got only 13% agreeing among the distant believers and 47% over here among the authoritarian believers. That's probably not too surprising. I think this is probably the end of this. Oh, this again was for the French. Corporal once said, religious insanity is very, very common in the United States. So I said, this is what your man said about us, and the data I've shown you might prove the point. Religious insanity is very common. So I want to switch now to if I can get this to work, to another data set. How are we doing on time?
Well, we're just about ready for...